Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that may not be suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. I'd like to emphasize that today's episode will have more graphic language than usual, and unfortunately, you will hear homophobic slurs and quotes. As much as I personally abhor that language, I feel that it is important to not whitewash this story. The murder I am talking about today was a catalyst in helping end the Don't Ask, Don't Tell era of the military. But while his death may have gone on to help the greater cause, we cannot lose sight of his suffering in silence. Nor should we forget the pain and grief it caused his family, friends, and his girlfriend. Yes, his girlfriend. For though he was widely reported as a gay man in news reports of the time, he was not in fact gay, nor conflicted about his own sexuality or masculinity. It was the fragile and toxic masculinity of his brothers in arms that cost him his life. He was beaten to death with a baseball bat while sleeping in the barracks at Fort Campbell in Kentucky at just 21 years old. Welcome to Episode 12, The Murder of PFC Barry Winchell, Casualty and Martyr of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This is my second case that takes us to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. The first one was covered in Episode 6 and 7 on the Kentucky Bordello murders. But that case did not directly involve the base or the military, more the culture surrounding the base and the small-town corruption that let a killer go free. I'm afraid the punishment for the killers in this case is also disappointing, but at least the military as a whole did in fact face a reckoning. Even though it would take more than 10 years for that reckoning to effect real change. Fort Campbell, sitting on over 100,000 acres, or 160 square miles, is more than 7 times the size of Manhattan. That is 257 kilometers for those not in the U.S. Today, it is home to about 30,000 soldiers. It has its own Starbucks, bowling alley, fast food joints, and is pretty much a small city unto itself. The base is home to 3 major combat units, the 5th Special Forces Group, the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, and, of course, the Screaming Eagles, the renowned 101st Airborne Division. The base sits on the border of Tennessee and Kentucky, closest to Hopkinsville and Clarksville in terms of larger cities, but close enough in proximity to Nashville that much of the story takes place there. Nashville, known worldwide as Music City, is the home of country music and the state capital of Tennessee. The infamous Music Row area is home to the Big Four record labels as well as many independent labels. Nashville's incredible music scene is not just for country music, but a wide variety of genres. And Nashville has the charm of a smaller southern city, but the amenities and diverse culture of a large city. You can visit an art museum, catch a Broadway play, take in the ballet, symphony, or opera, as well as visit the area that crackles with excitement known as Honky Tonk Highway. The Broadway and Second Avenue areas feature all kinds of entertainment venues, as well as restaurants, from fine dining to hot chicken, sushi, and meat and three diners. You'll find a variety that any foodie will adore. Oh, and don't forget the biscuits at Loveless Cafe. But it's really the nightclubs and honky-tonk bars that crowd downtown Nashville, particularly the area encompassing Lower Broadway, Second Avenue, and Printer's Alley, often referred to as the District. Perhaps surprisingly, as Nashville is pretty much smack dab in the middle of the Bible Belt, it has a large and welcoming gay community. And not just the numerous gay bars and nightclubs, but a vocal, active, and burgeoning enclave for the LGBTQ Nashvillians. Naturally, it hasn't always been this way, and of course, like the rest of the country, still has a ways to go. Jim Ridley of the Nashville Scene wrote that the history of gay Nashville could be measured by its nightclubs. It had Juanita's in the 60s, The Warehouse in the 80s, and then in 1993 a new club called The Connection opened up. After a couple of years, The Connection moved from its original spot on 5th and Demumbrian to a huge facility in the industrial district by the Cumberland River. It was a remote location, and so a risky move, but with over 44,000 square feet to spread out in, The Connection became an instant sensation, with more than 2,000 patrons on a given night. It had a patio with a fountain, a large lobby with mirrored walls and marble tile. There was a gift shop, then a second lobby, a huge dance club with the renowned DJ Russell, a smaller bar, and finally a large room with a stage, tables, and two bars that featured one of the premier drag shows in the South, or anywhere really. Former owner Todd Roman said, quote, "It gave everyone a great sense of pride. It bridged the gap between gay and straight. It brought out all those people who didn't feel comfortable going into some out-of-the-way bar." As you may have guessed, I'm from the Nashville area. In the 90s and on into the early 2000s, I often went and danced the night away with my friends at The Connection. A lot of girls felt safe there, free from unwanted male attention and the groping that is ubiquitous in other large nightclubs. Someone else felt safe there. A young, shy man, just out of the Navy, having completed a tour of duty in the Gulf War, and he came to check out the drag show. And finally, realized what he had known his whole life, that he felt like a woman, wanted to be a woman, and had finally found the place and community to become a woman. That night, Calpurnia Sarah Adams was born. She chose the name after seeing it on a headstone in the Adams Family movie. She liked it because the fictional Calpurnia was a witch who had danced naked through the streets and was burned at the stake. Brought up in a fundamentalist Christian home, not allowed to dance, roller skate, see movies, or anything else most children do to have fun, Calpurnia became a bookish dreamer. She never felt like she fit in, and in the New York Times, she described herself as a child in one of the most eloquent but bleak quotes I've ever read. She said, "I wasn't delicate, really, but I wasn't really boyish. I think I just wasn't anything. I was so busy concealing everything that I just came out as blank." She thought maybe she was homosexual, but really she just felt ugly and at times invisible. What she didn't understand was that she was suffering from gender dysphoria. Gender dysphoria is a condition where a person experiences discomfort or distress because there's a mismatch between their biological sex and their gender identity. She joined the Navy right out of high school and served as a combat medic in Saudi Arabia in the Gulf War. Despite her struggle with her own self-image, she mostly enjoyed her time in the Navy and was accepted by her peers. But soon she did suffer from depression, and after seeing a Navy psychologist who warned her not to discuss anything about it for risk of being shipped out on a gay discharge, she knew her time in the armed services was ending. She returned to Nashville in 1994, and The Connection was the first gay bar she'd ever been to. She donned her first wig and sparkly dress for the Wednesday night amateur show, and she felt transformed, lighter, like the person she'd always wanted to be. She began hormone treatments in 1997 and began saving towards gender reassignment surgery. With hormone therapy, her already wispy frame changed with real female curves, measuring 36, 30, 38. At almost 6 feet tall, she was a towering bombshell and a natural performer. Calpurnia had finally found her calling. She was the main draw at the club, with a huge dressing room and devoted fans who came to her shows religiously. One night, she caught the eye of a soldier from Fort Campbell. Justin Fisher went back to the base and could not quit raving to his friends about this gorgeous drag queen he had seen. He couldn't believe she could actually be male. He soon brought his buddies to see the show. The driver that weekend was his roommate, Private First Class Barry Winchell. And this night would forever change the lives of Fisher, Barry, and Calpurnia. They were now on paths that none of them could have predicted. A murderer, a martyr, and an activist. At this time, I'm going to pause and take a short break for a word from our sponsors. Barry Winchell was born in Kansas City, Missouri on August 31, 1977. He was almost 4 years old when his mother divorced his biological father, an abusive man, and fled with him and his older brothers. They moved several times as Patty Winchell struggled to provide for her boys. They were even homeless for about 6 weeks while in Fort Worth, Texas. She eventually met and married Wally Kutelis, a kind man and a Korean War veteran. He would become the father that Barry and his brothers needed. From then on, Barry never had contact with his real father and considered Wally to be his dad. Wally had a career in aerospace, and Patty worked as a psychiatric nurse with troubled children. The family moved to Florida, and though Barry was doing well emotionally after all that he'd been through in his young life, he was struggling in school. He was later diagnosed with attention deficit disorder and dyslexia. He did not learn to read until he was in the third grade. He did, however, show an aptitude for mechanics. But because of his learning disabilities, he was grouped with other special needs kids and became an outcast. He dropped out of high school, but entered a technical school where he was learning to be a welder. He got his GED and soon came to Wally and Pat and announced he wanted to join the Army. They had the typical reservations most parents do, but they knew Barry was a good kid. He'd been a normal teenager, had a girlfriend, probably experimented a little with alcohol and drugs, but never got into any trouble like some of his friends. With Wally's background in the military, he knew what his son was in for and asked him if he really thought he could handle it. Someone in his face, chewing him out. He would have to take it. He told Barry, "You're going to have to stand up and be a man." Barry confidently replied, "I can do that." We later find out that Barry could more than stand it. He excelled quickly in the Army, first in basic training at Fort Benning in Georgia, where he wrote happy letters home with lots of jokes and observations about his new military life, and proudly announced that he wanted to be the best. And he was on his way there. His next move was to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where he joined the Delta Company, 502nd Infantry Regiment, and 101st Airborne, trained to fire heavy artillery like 50-caliber machine guns and grenade launchers. Naturally, with his mechanical abilities, he was very talented with machinery and weapons and quickly became the best marksman in the company. For that achievement, his peers nicknamed him Top Gun. He called home at least once a week, always telling his proud parents of some exciting new award or praise. His captain thought he should be a helicopter pilot. Barry was disciplined, ambitious, and by all accounts had a bright future. His roommate, on the other hand, specialist Justin Fisher, was a hothead with a drinking problem. Growing up in Lincoln, Nebraska, he came from an abusive home with an alcoholic father. He also later had a physically abusive stepfather, causing him to leave home before he finished high school. He got by on low-paying maintenance and fast food jobs, fathering a child sometime in late 1996. He joined the Army in March of 1997, hoping to provide for his son and to get a new start. Fisher was known as the company Hellion. He could be a lot of fun to be around, but he could also be volatile and abusive to his friends. Later, other soldiers would describe him as obsessed with mob movies, gangsters, and thugs, and that he reveled in planning imaginary crimes or stories of revenge. While home on leave, he bought a Louisville Slugger bat, intending to assault a guy who was bothering his sister. He never made good on the threat, but even more ominously, he was arrested for having the makings of a pipe bomb. It's hard to believe with that on his record he made it into the Army, but it was a different time. In May of 1998, he was paired up with Barry in a third-floor dorm. The two were like oil and water from the beginning. Barry smoked, and Fisher hated smoking and wouldn't allow it in their room, although it was allowed in the barracks. He saw Barry as a do-gooder mama's boy, and often sneered and ridiculed him. He called him my bitch to their fellow soldiers. These arguments soon started getting violent. One night, a drunken argument culminated with Fisher sitting on Barry's chest and wailing on him. Then he cracked him over the head with a dustpan, for which Barry had to get several stitches. But Barry didn't complain. They were written up for the incident, but when questioned by their captain, they insisted they were friends and it was just a spat that had gotten out of hand, and that the dustpan hitting Barry had been an accident. It's highly likely, though, that Justin Fisher appealed to Barry's forgiving nature. He knew if Barry told the truth, he could be brought up on charges at an Article 15 hearing and then kicked out of the Army. Barry was no snitch, and oddly enough, despite this fight and the ongoing arguments, they did remain friends. The gash on Barry's head had caused some blood to splatter on the wall in their room, and Fisher wouldn't let him clean it up. It was like a badge of honor, something he proudly showed their friends. How Barry could stand this asshole is beyond me, but he did. After reading so much about Barry, his strength of character and innate kindness, I think maybe he felt sorry for Fisher. Before they became roommates, Justin Fisher had been to a drag club in Nashville. He had been to the Connection, and he came back absolutely raving to his buddies about a girl in a pink negligee with a sparkly thong that lip-synced to Madonna. Nashville is about an hour's drive from Fort Campbell, and one weekend, he talked Barry, who was one of the few on the base with his own car, into driving him and a couple more buddies there to see the show. You've probably guessed by now that the girl Justin Fisher was obsessing over was Calpurnia Adams. She remembers that night clearly. The boys came in on a Sunday night, sat close to the stage, and as she put it, started hooting and hollering every time she came on stage. As she always did, after the show, she mingled with the crowd, introducing herself to the soldiers. She says that she didn't notice Barry at first. He was shy and hung back. But when she did, she was immediately struck by his beautiful and kind eyes. The boys returned the following weekend, and after the drag show ended, they all went to an after-hours club called the Underground. It was there that Calpurnia and Barry really hit it off. Justin was jealous, but he took it surprisingly well, asking Calpurnia to set him up with a friend. That friend was a drag queen named Kimmy Satin. Unlike Calpurnia, Kimmy was still somewhat manly, with a conspicuous Adam's apple and a scruffy chin from shaving. She also was less ladylike when talking about the soldiers than Calpurnia would later be. Kimmy said, quote, "They come on Friday and Saturday nights, these little jarhead freaks from Fort Campbell who want a blowjob with a drag queen." She said she saw Fisher three or four times after that, with a lot of heavy petting, but it never really went any further. However, she said that there was no mistaking he was attracted to her, and he was very aggressive. He even asked her if she could still get hard, putting her hand on his own erection. But Kimmy and Justin never had more than a passing flirtation, some quick groping backstage at the Connection. What Calpurnia and Barry had was real, and it was surprising to both of them. Calpurnia held many of the same opinions of her more crude friend, but she seemed to understand the nature of supposedly straight men coming on to transgender women. She said, "One of the cold hard facts is that a lot of straight men who are attracted to us are actually closeted gay, and they may not have even admitted it to themselves. We bring them into the gay community and introduce them to people, and they start to get comfortable. And the next little step is that they leave us behind and start dating men. It's really lonely." She, of course, did have reservations about Barry at first, but it didn't take long for him to win her trust. She told the New York Times, quote, "He was never ashamed to go anywhere with me. He treated me just like a normal girl. And that was the most wonderful feeling, to have an attractive, masculine, nice man treat me like a woman, like I wanted to be treated. He put me at peace and gave me a feeling of self-confidence that I had never had. I told you a lot about Calpurnia in the beginning of the episode, and you'll hear me often quote her verbatim because I find her such a thoughtful and well-spoken woman. But I need to point out that at the time, the notion of being transgender was often seen as being merely a gay man who liked to wear women's clothing. She knew this was not her. She wanted to be a woman, and didn't even like the terminology of fluidity that was beginning around that time. She firmly identified as a woman and would eventually complete her transition. Though she never gave much detail about their sex life, nor is it really anyone's business, she did say that it was normal. Whatever normal could be for them, again, not our business. She was already a couple of years into hormone treatment and was serious about having gender reassignment surgery. But she said that Barry insisted he did not care either way. He loved her in whatever body she chose for herself. And he never saw her as less than a woman. She said he was very wholesome and gentlemanly. She said, "It's kind of cliche to say he had a childlike quality, but that's what he had. He was always treating me like a lady, bringing me jewelry and things. Barry was the type of man who would undo the jelly jar if it was stuck." Their romance blossomed quickly. Instead of spending his weekends drinking with his pals, Barry usually hung out in Calpurnia's dressing room, studying his manuals while she performed. Friends all agree that the relationship was really special, that they were so in love and were always together. Going to the movies or just for coffee, always walking hand in hand. Calpurnia felt a deep love and commitment from Barry and really trusted a man for the first time. However, she didn't know what all this bliss in Nashville was costing him back at the base. From that first weekend that Justin Fisher took Barry Winchell to the Connection, his first time at a gay bar, the volatile bad boy routine took on a more sinister and vicious tone. In the car going back to the base, Justin started slapping and even choking Barry, tearing off his shirt and screaming that he'd been wanting to kick Barry's ass for a long time. In context now, I think it's pretty clear that Fisher was jealous of Barry and possibly even attracted to him. Barry told Calpurnia of one night in the barracks when he awoke to Justin fondling his feet. When he asked him what the hell he was doing, Fisher just said, "Oh, sorry, man, I'm just drunk." But then Justin Fisher immediately started rumors about Barry on the base. The next day, after the first night at the Connection, unbeknownst to Barry, Fisher reported to his unit sergeant that someone who he wouldn't name was seeing another man. And things only escalated from there. He openly and constantly harassed Barry in front of their fellow soldiers, calling him a faggot, a dumb fuck, and a queer fuck. One of Barry's friends, specialist Luis Ruiz, actually called him out, saying, "Dude, you kissed a guy." Of course, Justin Fisher claimed he was too drunk to remember or too drunk to notice that it was a man. Either way, he swept his own homosexual tendencies under the rug by outing Barry to the entire company. Also, Ruiz had the authority to report the original fight in the car leaving the Connection, and he could have recommended a separation of the two soldiers before the abuse on base even started. It should have been clear by now that Barry and Justin were a terrible fit as roommates. But he did nothing. Later at trial, he said it was just part of being on a base, sort of boys will be boys, and that Barry and Justin had a love-hate relationship. But Fisher would not stop, and soon he had just about the whole company in on it. It became a sort of blood sport for the men. Everyone got in on taunting and harassing Barry. It was a daily gauntlet that he bore in silence. One of his fellow soldiers asked right in front of their section leader, "Do you take it in the ass or the mouth?" And under the don't ask, don't tell policy, Barry could do nothing about it but endure the escalating abuse. Even just mentioning it, not even reporting it, could get him kicked out of the army. He didn't even tell Calpurnia. He never complained. He didn't tell his family or other friends. He just took it. He took it like the man he promised his dad he would be. But this was not what Wally had meant when he cautioned his son. Evidently, most of Barry's superiors had no trouble with his behavior, despite the Army's own code of ethics, which commands soldiers to respect one and all. I guess they didn't find words like faggot, rope sucker, butt pirate, and butt fucker derogatory. With all this going on, there was now a new soldier on base that Justin Fisher would eventually befriend, named Calvin Glover. The private was a troubled 18-year-old from Oklahoma, where he'd had problems with drugs and alcohol, dropping out of school in the 8th grade. His mother knew he was out of control, had few friends, and no direction in life. They both saw the Army as a way out. For her, he would finally get the role models he so needed, and for Calvin, he was looking for friendship and a place where he could belong. He didn't find that at Fort Campbell. He was still awkward and became known for drunken antics, trying to get attention and acceptance. He also was not shy about his racist and anti-Semitic ideas, proudly showing off his crude Aryan cross tattoo. Justin Fisher was just the kind of macho badass that Calvin looked up to. He soon took the boy under his wing, plying him with booze and egging him on to even more stupid stunts in front of his friends, and, of course, he showed him the ropes and harassing Barry Winchell. But the gay bashing Barry endured did not just come from the regular rank and file. Even a drill sergeant on a 5-mile company run shouted a homophobic cadence while leading the platoon, bellowing, "Faggot, faggot down the street, shoot him, shoot till he retreats." Pretty much everyone called him derogatory names, said Platoon Sergeant Michael Kliefken, who was friendly with Winchell. "They called him a faggot, I would say, on a daily basis," he said. Later, in a misguided attempt at counseling Barry, he plainly asked him if he was gay. Barry firmly denied it. This was a direct violation of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. If Barry couldn't say that he was gay, Sergeant Kliefken was equally prohibited from asking him if he was gay. But like with everything else, Barry let it go, or at least he seemed to. Later, at the murder trial, it came out that Barry did complain to Captain Daniel Rouse. Rouse told his men to knock that shit off, but did nothing else to stop the harassment. However, Sergeant Kliefken did take it a step further. However misguided he was in asking Barry under the strict rules of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, he did really seem to care for the young man. He heard his direct superior, First Sergeant Roger Seacrest, say of Barry, quote, "The faggot has got a fucking drinking problem, and I'm going to do something about it." Kliefken took the professionally risky step of reporting Seacrest to the post's inspector general. He also brought the matter to the attention of the company commander. "It was basically blown off," he said. "I filed a formal complaint. Nothing was done about it." Everyone on the base was ignoring the escalating problem, but there were signs that it was starting to get to Barry as well. On the 4th of July weekend, Calpurnia was set to compete in the Tennessee Entertainer of the Year pageant. Naturally, she wanted her boyfriend there to support her, but for once he declined, even though it was a long holiday weekend. She tried not to get her feelings hurt as he explained that he had a lot of studying to do and that it was his turn to look after the company dog. I think at this point, Barry knew things were getting dangerous. Maybe he thought if he hung around the base that holiday, hanging with the guys, he could start turning things around. Calpurnia was confused and a little hurt, but she loved Barry and respected his wishes. She headed off to the pageant, and Barry settled in for the long weekend on base. That Saturday night, a sweltering July in the south, Barry and a lot of the soldiers were hanging around the concrete picnic tables drinking. Someone had tapped a keg, and everyone was getting rowdy, particularly Calvin Glover. He loved to brag about his supposed exploits before the army, week-long meth benders, fights, and even robberies. And Justin Fisher was in turn egging him on and then also mocking him. Glover was getting on everyone's nerves, but oddly enough, considering how long he'd been keeping his head down, it was Barry Winchell who finally had enough and shouted at Glover, "Why don't you take your drunk cherry ass to bed?" This enraged Glover. Later in the trial, his father said, "He lived in fear of being rejected and humiliated. He would do anything to feel important and accepted." And he definitely wasn't about to take shit from the company faggot, the company whipping boy who took abuse from just about everyone there on a daily basis. He started screaming that he would kick Barry's faggot ass, and Barry, unafraid, never even stood up. He just sat there smoking and finally said, "Well, come on if you think you can." Calvin tried to knock the beer out of his hand, but Barry suddenly jumped up and pounced, bringing him to the ground, and pounded Glover's face with several swift punches. It ended quickly. He got up and tried to help Calvin up and said, "Let's end this." Instead of feeling vindicated by getting some revenge on one of his tormentors, Barry was upset and was determined to set things right. He brought over another beer and some Southern Comfort to Calvin and said, "It's cool, right?" trying to shake his hand. But Justin Fisher was still in Calvin Glover's ear and would not stop laughing and ridiculing him. "It's not cool," Glover screamed. "I could fucking kill you. A faggot cannot kick my ass." At this, Barry left and went to bed. And the next day, which was the 4th of July, it seemed the ugly incident had passed. Barry had again apologized, and this time Calvin had accepted, and the two were playing wiffle ball, with Barry even teaching him to juggle at some point that afternoon. But of course, the one who wouldn't let it go was Justin Fisher. It was always Fisher. He was relentless when he got his mind set on something, and he berated Glover, saying, "You ain't got a hair on your ass if you're gonna let a fucking faggot take you down." Still, Calvin seemed to remain somewhat calm. He wasn't trying to actively fight Barry anymore, and the party was dying down around 2 a.m. when the keg ran dry. Barry went off to bed. He took the dog, named Nasty, and then took his own cot out into the hallway outside the dorm room, not wanting to face Justin Fisher's wrath if Nasty made a mess in their room. He soon fell asleep, with the dog tethered to a nearby stair railing. At the same time, at 2:30 a.m. in Nashville, Calpurnia Adams had just brought down the house with a haunting lip-sync rendition of "Don't Cry For Me, Argentina," while actually playing the violin herself. She beat out drag queens and stage legends from across the state that night, being crowned Tennessee Entertainer of the Year, not knowing what the love of her life had been going through back at base, not knowing what tragedy was about to crash into her life. Not knowing that almost the exact moment the crown was placed on her head, Barry was being viciously assaulted. Glover and Fisher had gone back to Fisher and Barry's dorm room. They kept on drinking, listening to heavy metal, and continuing to obsess over the incident with Barry. From Fisher's later testimony, he showed Glover his Louisville Slugger bat, and Calvin Glover, eyeing the bat, said, "I ought to go out there and fuck him up." Justin Fisher said, "Then go for it." He then claims that he put on his Walkman earphones and went to lie down on his own bed, supposedly oblivious to what he had just put in motion. Calvin Glover walked out to the hallway and swung the bat down repeatedly on Barry's head. Barry was asleep and never saw him coming. He kept bashing repeatedly, sending blood splatter all over the walls and even down the long corridor. Even with Nasty the dog barking, no one in the barracks that night claimed to hear anything. Glover went back in the room and handed Justin Fisher the bloody bat. Fisher cleaned it off in the sink and then hid it in his closet, telling Glover, "This just stays inside the family. You and me are in the family. Don't take this outside the family." Later, friends would say this sounded just like something Fisher would say, straight out of one of his favorite mob movies. At first, they considered dumping Barry's body in the river. They searched for the keys to his car, hoping to make it look like an accident, but they couldn't find them. So Fisher told Glover to run, and he did, straight out of the barracks into the night. It was now more than a half hour since the assault, and Fisher finally sounded the alarm. As Glover ran, he threw his bloody clothes into a dumpster while Fisher pulled the fire alarm. Then fellow soldiers rushed in and saw a horrifying scene. Aside from the alarming amount of blood all over the walls and floor, they saw that Barry's eyes had already turned black, indicating cerebral hemorrhaging. There was blood coming out of his ears. Brain matter was oozing out of the cracks in his skull, and his entire head had swollen to the size of a basketball. One of the soldiers applied a field dressing as another ran to call 911. What they didn't know is that for some strange reason, 911 was down on the base. They could not call out. The soldier then had to run out to a payphone to call an ambulance. Before paramedics could arrive, Justin Fisher, wailing and screaming the whole time, tried picking Barry up in a field cradle. I think this was maybe to explain the blood he was covered in, because I'm not convinced that Justin Fisher didn't watch what Calvin Glover did to Barry. The ambulance finally arrived at 3:30 a.m., an hour after the assault. If there had ever been a chance to save Barry, it was more than likely too late now. He was rushed to Vanderbilt Hospital in Nashville. As the soldiers stood around, they saw Glover come back and stand with them, sweaty, out of breath, and covered in grass. They also remembered something crazy that Fisher screamed as the ambulance was pulling out. "No balls," he yelled. "No balls! Let him die! Let him die!" Barry Winchell was put on life support at Vanderbilt, and the colonel on base called his parents on the early morning of July the 5th, just as Pat was making coffee. He informed her that her son had been kicked in the head with a boot and was in the hospital. A call to the hospital confirmed the worst. Barry had suffered irreparable brain damage and was struggling feebly against a coma. He had very little chance of living, much less recovering without serious brain damage. Pat and Wally jumped on the next plane for Nashville and went straight to the trauma unit where they found Barry clinging to life on a respirator. At the same time, Calpurnia had returned home from the pageant. She was happily walking around her apartment and unpacking while listening to the news. She heard Barry's name and almost stopped breathing. The news was vague, just that there had been some sort of attack on base and that he was in the hospital. She immediately called Vanderbilt, but of course, since she was not a family member, they would not give her any details. She wanted desperately to go to the hospital, but was afraid to face his family. This would be the first time they met her, and she knew Barry had not told them the complete story. Barry's parents learned from the doctors that it wasn't a boot that caused the fatal injuries on their son, but that it had been a fellow soldier's baseball bat. By the morning of the 6th, they knew there was no hope. They kissed Barry goodbye and turned off life support. He died shortly after. Calpurnia also heard this update from the news. At least this time, she had gone to a friend's house. She was wrapped in blankets in severe shock, and she was devastated. One of the first things she tried to do was develop a roll of film she had with pictures of the two of them. To her deep sadness, there was something wrong with the film or in the processing, and none of the pictures came out. She sent what few photos she had, along with a small photograph of herself, to his parents. At this point, it was already all over the papers that Barry's girlfriend was a drag queen from a local club in Nashville. She put a note with the photograph that said, "Just to settle your mind, this is me. I tried to be a good person, and I just hope that you can find it in your heart not to hate me. At first, his mother was a bit hurt that Barry hadn't told his parents. After all, they had raised him in a very liberal and accepting household. They would not have been disappointed in him. But time let her see the truth. She said, "When I found out Calpurnia was a transsexual, that was a bit surprising. But she is a very nice person, and she really cared about Barry. Knowing he was in a happy relationship, in the end, that helped. When we talked, he was just so optimistic about his future." As if losing their son in such a vicious attack wasn't bad enough, in early December of 1999, before Calvin Glover's trial, they received a call from Captain Greg Engler, the lead prosecutor. He told Wally that they were trying for plea deals for Glover and Fisher. Wally and Pat agreed to this, hoping they would snitch on each other and both get more time. They were devastated when the captain called back 2 days later and told them that Fisher had accepted 12 and a half years to testify against Glover. "The general wants the Batman," is what he said. "You've already got him," is what Wally said back, to which the captain replied, "No, not really. The forensics suck." Never mind the callous wording in this call. How could they have failed so badly? The truth is, they had struck deals with both of the soldiers. In December, Calvin Glover was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole in 60 years. Justin Fisher got his 12-year sentence for obstruction of justice for hiding the bat, for making false statements, and also for providing alcohol to a minor. This last one was certainly a moot point, considering that the entire base, including superior officers, knew that Calvin Glover not only drank underage, but that he was an alcoholic, and they had done nothing. The Catelluses were incensed and soon partnered with the SLDN, or the Service Members Legal Defense Network. They knew their son was now a political figure, and they intended to bring about change in his honor. The SLDN started their own investigation into Private Winchell's death after receiving many tips from Fort Campbell soldiers. And this was not the first time the military had been caught up in a gay hate crime scandal. A soldier overseas was beaten and kicked to death while in Japan on a naval base. His head and face were so bashed in, among the other horrific wounds to his body, that he had to be identified by the tattoos on his arms. The Navy tried to cover up the murder, and they almost succeeded. But the tide was finally changing. President Clinton declared that "Don't Ask, Don't Tell" was not working. He later said that at the time, it was the best he could do for gays in the military. That had he tried a full open-door policy, a bill like that would never have passed through both houses, much less Congress. He did the best he could at the time. Vice President Al Gore vowed to change the policy during his presidential campaign. The SLDN called for General Robert T. Clark, the commanding officer at Fort Campbell, to step down, as did 27 members of Congress. He refused, though he did accept responsibility in a formal statement, for what happened on his base, and then started his own investigation. I won't even get into that, because I'm sure by now you know that it was mainly self-serving, the whole "we didn't know what was going on" bullshit that they later reported. However, the case did cause him some career issues. His promotion to Lieutenant General was delayed in October of 2002 and May of 2003. He was exonerated by the military, who of course had found that Fort Campbell was not a hostile environment, and he was nominated and approved for promotion to Lieutenant General on December 5th, 2003. In the 6 months following Barry's death, more than 20,000 soldiers willingly succumbed to discharge under the "Don't Ask, Don't Tell" policy, fearing for their own lives. 126 soldiers from Fort Campbell alone. Unable to go through legal channels to get the people in charge fired for what happened to their son, the Catelluses tried to sue the Army, as we normally would in a wrongful death suit in civil court. Of course, this was really impossible due to the Ferris Doctrine, which came from a 1950 Supreme Court decision that states that although military can be sued for negligence, it is exempt when it comes to soldiers who are killed during the course of military service. There is obviously good reason for this law, as being in the military is inherently dangerous and life-threatening. But Barry's parents were arguing that their son's murder did not occur during the course of military service and that he was beaten to death after superior officers had ignored signs of the breach of the Army's own codes of conduct. But there was no historic precedent for such a claim. The courts have always demonstrated a deference to the military's own laws under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So Pat and Wally Coutelis decided to drop the case, but became vocal advocates for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. For more than 10 years, they and Calpurnia Adams became very visible and loud activists for this cause. Finally, in July of 2011, President Barack Obama, who had promised in his own campaign to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, formally announced an end to the act, saying, "As of September 20th, service members will no longer be forced to hide who they are in order to serve our country." While gays are now openly allowed in the military, it doesn't mean that they don't face a great deal of prejudice and danger to this day. And Donald Trump has already introduced a bill that would stop the ascension of transgender servicemen and women in the military. This bill is still being debated and nothing has been set in stone. The argument I hear most is that people do not feel the government should have to pay for sex reassignment surgery, which is very expensive. I kind of get that, or at least I understand why people don't see it as a necessary medical treatment. For those with gender dysphoria, though, it is. Hopefully, we will get to a place where everybody understands the challenges of this disorder. As long as the government does allow their transgender members to continue to receive hormone treatments, I feel this would be a fair compromise for now. But then, Don't Ask, Don't Tell began as a compromise too, so I'm not very sure what the right answer is. Only time will tell if our government will do right by all men and women who give their lives for our country. Sadly, Pat Coutelis passed away in November of 2016, but her husband is still an advocate and still attends the annual SLDN dinner every year to present the Barry Winchell Courage Award to members of the service who actively fight hate and work to change the culture. Calpurnia Adams went on to be an icon for the transgender community and to this day remains a very vocal activist. Sadly, she was somewhat mistreated by the gay community in the immediate aftermath of Barry's death. They feared that his death would not be considered a hate crime if she insisted on being named a woman in the use of feminine pronouns. She fought this, and they eventually came to a peace. She said, "I was eager to assert that Barry was attracted to women and show that I was not the media's common stereotype of a transsexual, a street-dwelling prostitute, a linebacker in a dress, or a guilty husband caught in his wife's knickers." Bill Turner, a Nashville activist and author, said at the time, "Calpurnia Adams has really fallen victim to our limitations," as he was speaking on the clarity of the vocabulary of the time. But nevertheless, Miss Adams persisted. She worked tirelessly for transgender and all LGBTQ rights. She also had much success when she left Nashville for Hollywood. She starred in a few smaller movies and TV shows, but perhaps her most important work was guiding two very important performances. First was for the movie Soldier's Girl. It is about Barry and Calpurnia's love story, but also about the murder and what led to it. She worked closely with Lee Pace, who played her in the film. It was a TV movie for Showtime, and it won the Peabody Award and was nominated for several Golden Globes and Emmys. She also coached Jared Leto's Academy Award-winning performance in the Dallas Buyers Club. She has received some negative attention for this in the transgender community, as they are tired of straight men or even gay men playing transgender roles. She stands firm in her belief that the stories need to be told no matter who plays the part, that it is all for the greater good. I watched the movie Soldier's Girl while researching this episode, and it is absolutely incredible. The movie itself is so well done, but the performances of Lee Pace as Calpurnia and Troy Garrity as Barry are truly remarkable. And of course, Sean Hattasey was very effective in his role as the unhinged Justin Fisher. These days, you can find Calpurnia on her own podcast called Nooner with Alec and Calpurnia. Her show is delightful and topical. Along with her co-host, Alec Mappa, Calpurnia Adams has found yet another platform for her special brand of magic. It is in the comedy section in iTunes, but I will also provide a link in my show notes. I do ask, though, that if you feel the need to reach out to Calpurnia, that you don't ask her questions about Barry or what she went through. I suggest you go to her website, calpurnia.com, and read her extensive blog. While she understands this story will always remain in the hands of the public, it is still a very deep and raw heartache to her, and she prefers not to discuss it. I ask that you please respect her wishes and go support her other endeavors. And to give you an update on Glover and Fisher, Calvin Glover is still serving out his life sentence at Fort Leavenworth. Justin Fisher was released after serving just 7 years. I'm sure that will disgust you as much as it does me. I consider him to be the mastermind and the real reason Barry died. I believe he was entrenched in internalized homophobia. Many things about him came out after the trial. Not just his dalliance with Kimmy Satin, but his other visits to gay clubs, and also, he had been wearing women's underwear since his teen years. He clearly was jealous, either of Barry because he wanted Calpurnia, but more likely he was attracted to Barry. He did have that one strange moment when Barry caught him fondling his feet as he slept. And he was the one to take Barry to his first gay club. It's possible he was trying to come to grips with his own sexuality. And it is not at all uncommon for closeted gay men to go through a period of self-loathing. Dave Cullen, author of the critically acclaimed and award-winning book Columbine, is now working on a book set in the era of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He wrote an article about it in Vanity Fair not long after the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting, another incident many in the gay community feel was due to internalized homophobia. Mr. Cullen posits that internalized homophobia and the often resulting violence is fairly common. He said, "Is it hard to picture a troubled gay guy lashing out at his own kind? When you hate the gay, it's much easier to attack it in other people than to face down your own demons." He also served in the military himself before he came out as a gay man during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell era. He said it is not uncommon for gay men who have not come out to join the military, the very pinnacle of masculinity, to try and overcome their self-hatred. His book is scheduled for release sometime in 2019. If you are interested, you should follow him on social media. He remains very active, working as an expert analyst when mass shootings occur. For me, I hope the work that Calpurnia Adams, Dave Cullen, and Barry's family, and so many others continue to do will affect real change in our country. We need to change our culture to be more accepting in every aspect, not just in the military. I will leave you with the words of Pat Catellus, Barry's late mother. "If we don't fight against hate crimes and for those people who are targeted, I feel as if we're letting Barry down. Because that's what Barry would have fought for. He would have fought for the rights of everybody, no matter how hard it is, no matter how long it takes. I have to fight for my son's ideals, and that's what we're doing." I hope that Pat and Barry know that the good people are still fighting and will continue to do so as long as it takes. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Special thanks to the divine Miss Calpurnia Adams, who graciously gave me her blessing to tell this story. don't forget, she has her own podcast, Nooner with Alec and Calpurnia. So please go check it out and show her some love. I have links to all things Calpurnia in my show notes. As always, if you enjoyed the show, tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I know iTunes reviews are a pain, but it is still the best way for others to find Southern Fried, so I really appreciate your help. I'm also on Stitcher and many other apps. If you're interested in supporting the show, come check out my Patreon page, and I've also recently updated my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, to include a donate option if you would like to make just a one-time donation. I also have some fantastic merch now. Please visit my shop at whatamaneuver.net to check it out. We have t-shirts, tanks, hoodies, and even onesies for babies. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I am also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing Barry's case, or Don't Ask, Don't Tell further, come check out my discussion group. It is linked to my main Facebook page. I would love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.